You're listening to Dublin City FM. This is Inside Education. My name is Sean Delaney, and we have a specially extended programme this evening, given the time of year, and Sunday Scoreboard is not on this week. And I'm with you from 7 o'clock until 8. Before the break there, you heard Professor Joe Bowler from the University of Sussex explaining why it's a mistake. It's mistaken to think that people are either naturally good or naturally bad at maths. And if you want to hear more of what Joe Bowler had to say, you can tune in to the programme's website. That is www.insideed.com, where you can download the podcast. And Joe Bowler was on the programme in October, and it was programme number 14. Another expert that visited this country in the autumn was Professor Peter Afflerbach from the University of Maryland. He was the guest of the Reading Association of Ireland, and he spoke at their annual conference, which was held at the end of September. He's an expert on the teaching of reading, and when I spoke to him, I asked Peter Afflerbach why some children have difficulties in learning to read.
There are a number of reasons why someone might have trouble learning to read, and you know, I would say that the number of students who actually have an organic problem, something that represents hearing, speech, vision, some sort of wiring in the brain that just is not allowing reading development to happen, is actually a quite small number. In the clinics that I've worked in and the classrooms that I've been teacher in, what I see most often happening when there's difficulty is there's a mismatch between one of three things, and it's the student and where the student is developmentally. Then it's the nature of the text that the student is asked to read, and then the nature of the instruction. So if the instruction's not meeting the student exactly where the student is, then there will be misses. There'll be instructional misses. There won't be a connection of what the student can do to what they can do next. And then there's the text difficulty issue, which is some texts are just going to be too hard for students. If the vocabulary, information load, length of average length of sentence is too grand, then it will overwhelm the students. It will overwhelm their memory system. It will overwhelm their will to persevere. And so when you look at a classroom of struggling readers, you're looking at students who have often have cognitive challenges, but as important would be the affective challenges. They've learned that they're not so good at reading, and that becomes a growing knot in the process of trying to develop as a reader. It's as your self-image deteriorates, as your self-concept gets low, thinking about reading, it's human nature to back away from that, and that's part of the challenge of teaching a struggling reader.
So if you take those different causes of reading difficulty, say presumably if the text is too difficult, that's fairly easy to correct by finding alternative text. And what about, say, if there's an instructional problem, that's a matter of changing the instruction.
Right, right.
And the probably the most difficult one is if a child has some cognitive difficulties. What can be done in those cases to help those children learn to read?
Well, of course, I'd say the most important thing, if you're dealing with a child with an organic deficit, is an accurate, detailed diagnosis, because you want to put your best effort in as a teacher, a diagnostician also, and you want the effort to be directed by the most fine-grained detail that you can have about exactly what is causing the problem with the child. In my experience, though, it's not always just it's not a single etiology. It's not a single cause. It's about, you think about a third grader, a fourth grader, who's had a career of failing in reading. And whatever you determine a cognitive need to be, you better address the affective need. You better address the probability that there's low motivation or no motivation to read. That you have to address the probability that the student will have very low self-esteem. And as I said earlier, there are very few human beings who like to participate in activities in which they know they're going to look bad and feel bad. And so avoidance routines develop along with whatever cognitive issues the student may have.
So if you want to motivate a child to read, and if the child doesn't particularly like reading, how can a teacher or a parent help that child want to read?
Well, I would start with the idea that I'd like to put a nice affective umbrella over all the work that I do as a teacher of skills and strategies. And I want to impress upon the child that I believe in them, that I know that they're capable of succeeding. And I would then really try to find out what makes the child happy and what are the interests of the child. And it turns out that there are so many books in the world that if we know the children well, we can probably find reading material that will be of interest to them. And then it's a matter of matching interest and reading level to a particular text. And this is, of course, very challenging. As class sizes get larger, it's much more difficult for the teacher to meet the individual needs of individual students.
It really does come back to interest and motivation, doesn't it, when you want to get children to learn in primary school. That was Professor Peter Afflerbach, and he was the guest of the Reading Association of Ireland at their annual conference in September this year. And he featured on two Inside Education programmes. That particular extract is taken from programme 13. From an international expert now, we hear next from a homegrown expert. Paddy Madden is known among many teachers for his work on the environment and heritage generally. In fact, this year he won the INTO Heritage Council Marion Rollins Award for Heritage in Education. And indeed, it was very well deserved. Paddy was featured on two programmes this year, on programme 23 and 22. In programme 23, I asked Paddy what advice he would give to teachers who want the children they teach to become passionate about the environment.
To get children involved, you really have to work on their senses from an early age, because I think what's remembered from the senses will be carried on through life. If children enjoy smelling flowers as children, they will always love smelling flowers. If children enjoy working with the soil and digging the soil and getting the rhythm of that, they will always be gardeners. If children enjoy touching trees and seeing the textures and looking at leaves and touching them, they will always enjoy the sensual experience of doing that. So I think we don't work enough on the children's senses, because they carry that all their life, and smell and touch and all of those. It was from a primary school teacher that I learned most of my love of the environment, you know, back in primary days.
And I want to come back to that a little bit later, Paddy, but if you were talking to a post-primary school teacher, would your advice to them be any different for how to help post-primary students be passionate about the environment?
Yeah, my advice would be the same. Get them up and get them out, really. Get them up and get them out. I think it's so sad sometimes, you know, and I've looked at some of my own children, and they, you know, they did get a very good secondary education. But sometimes, for example, in geography, I would say, why would they have only one field trip, you know, maybe in a year, maybe none at all? How can they learn about rocks and soil without actually getting out there and doing some investigation on the outside? I'd say to secondary teachers, don't be textbook bound, the same as I'd say to primary teachers, don't be bound by the textbook, because that kind of learning will not stick, it will not last, it will not be internalised. It's the outdoor learning, getting them to use all their senses, that becomes permanent and forever.
And that was Paddy Madden. In a previous programme, Paddy described how the school garden he set up in Skultrasa on Donore Avenue had an extraordinary effect on the children in the school. I asked Paddy how the children responded to the school garden.
They absolutely loved it. I mean, the children could never get enough of going out to that garden and working, not alone growing the vegetables and the excitement of seeing them grown. But I remember children that would have difficulties learning academically, they they thrived in the garden. And I'll tell you why, because there was no sense of failure in that garden. There was always success. Whether you watered the seeds, that was a success. When the seeds came up, that was a success. And of course, when you eat peas and carrots raw, that surely is a success. And we also found that children socialised better in the garden, in the sense that it wasn't in a classroom situation where you had the teacher looking down on the children. The children were really working parallel with one another. And it's an amazing thing. If you ever see children working parallel to one another on a bed of vegetable sowing, they open up and talk because there's no threat. There's nobody looking at them, no one staring them in the face. They're far more relaxed in the garden. And we used it for not alone for just nature study and science, of course. We use it for maths and measuring the heights of trees and the area of canopies of trees, the ages of trees. We look for shapes in the garden. And then when you're talking about... I'll always remember the best poetry ever had written in that lovely school was on the crispest, frostiest day coming up. I think it was probably after Christmas in January, and I brought the children out to the garden, and they were fascinated with the texture of the frost and on the grass, you know, and the crunch under their feet, and of course the pond had frozen over. And we went back to my school days and did what we used to do with the local rivers, was to break the ice and hear the clatter. Well, that sound, that I can still hear the screams of excitement as we broke the ice on it. And then we looked at the berries on the trees that particular day. The rowan berries were very plentiful and they were very red. And we saw these thrushes eating the berries. And just looking around, smelling, getting them to close their eyes, hear the sounds, getting them to touch and feel. They came in, their faces were red, they were healthy. And I got them to write acrostic poetry and different kinds of poetry, limericks and that, on the experience. And I still have and I still treasure those poems that were written on that magical day.
And that was Paddy Madden, who was a guest on programmes 22 and 23 on the occasion of his winning the Marion Rollins Heritage and Education Award 2009. You're listening to Inside Education on 103.2 Dublin City FM. My name is Sean Delaney. Each week on the programme, Barry Hennessy looks at what has been happening in education news during the week. At the end of last week's programme, I asked Barry to pick out the two stories that stood out for him among all those he covered in the last year. The first news report that Barry chose was one from the end of September, when, following meetings between school managers and unions, Paul Rowe from Educate Together seemed to agree that pay cuts for teachers may be on the cards. Here's a clip from that news report from Barry. It begins with Barry asking a follow-up question to one of Paul Rowe's previous comments.
When people hear you using terminology such as a divergence, they will wonder, for example, in the light of, I suppose, macro comments coming from the government recently with regard to pay cuts for public sector workers, whether in fact the management side in primary school would wish to see pay cuts for teachers ahead of further actual losses in the numbers of teachers in the system.
Well, I think this is a very, very sensitive issue in the wider context. No responsible employer is going to be comfortable with a situation which sees the morale of their workforce and their pay and condition of their workforce diminished. And so this whole issue has to be addressed very, very simply. Sorry, very sensitively. From a management point of view, we would be very clearly making the case publicly as bodies who have no financial interest in this situation. We'd be making the case for the absolute priority of investing in primary education for the future of the country. We think that this is a strategic imperative, which must be part of any rational plan that any government would be making in the current circumstances.
But just for the sake of clarity, very briefly, Paul Rowe, if I might, because clearly when the government sits down to take budgetary decisions, it's going to have to look at the numbers in the public sector and the payroll costs in the public sector. Are you in fact suggesting that really they should look at services, in other words, perhaps looking at payroll, looking at reducing payroll costs in order to keep the maximum, keep the service provided at the maximum level possible?
I think what I'm saying, to be very, very straight, direct about this, is that we're living in deflationary times, and I think in the context of a real and concrete plan for developing a sustainable and growing economy, that we should all be prepared to take the necessary steps to ensure that that plan is sensible, that it's workable, and it's going to achieve results. And in that context, I personally believe that all of us would be prepared to see fair and equitable reductions in our income in order to contribute to the future health of the economy and society.
And that clip was first broadcast on September 28, 2009. The second story that Barry Hennessy picked out related to an interview with a former secondary school pupil named Noel, who described his experience of being gay in school. One question that Barry asked Noel, based on his experience, was what teachers should do if a student comes out to them as gay or lesbian.
Well, support, first and foremost, and reassurance. It could be coming from parents, then again, it may not be reassurance that, it's not an abnormality, which amazingly in schools is the feeling you're given. So that main one, and, information and support, they can go to even outside school, youth groups, counsellors, anything like that. Mm-hmm. But even basic levels of support, which I felt now aren't really being given in schools these days.
Can you understand that there might be a bit of a reluctance among teachers in addressing a student's sexuality, particularly if the teacher feels, well, I wonder now, is he going through a phase, for example?
Oh, absolutely. Well, there'll be a number of it. That's a particular one that a lot of people say. It's a phase, teenagers go through this. Another one that I've heard from friends and asked teachers about is that it's genuine fear. A lot of other parents might have a problem with it coming up in class or even on a personal level. There are some teachers that could be, I didn't have the experience, but hostile towards themselves. But a good perception would be that it's just a phase, and be very dismissive towards the subject itself.
So, Noel, when you look back now, having left school, when you look back on your school years, do you have a broadly happy memory of your school years, or how would you describe your overall feelings looking back now on your education?
I wouldn't say it was my happiest years, but, I managed. I got through it. It wasn't the worst. Same as any other student, I imagine. It was slightly harder, I think, the fact that I was gay, and that there was just another reason of hardship to face in school. But it was okay, anyway.
And that was Noel there, a member of the gay youth group Belong To. And if you'd like to contact Belong To, they can be reached via their website, belongto.org, or by phone at 01670 6223.
And Barry is not around this evening, but Barry Hennessy will be presenting the morning programme on Dublin City FM throughout the coming week. That is from 10 to 12 each morning. It promises to be a lively programme. And Barry is the regular news reporter here on Inside Education every Sunday evening from 7:30 to 8 on Dublin City FM and 103.2 Dublin City FM. Another international speaker who spoke in Ireland this year was Jim Cummins. He was a guest of the English Language Support Teachers Association, and I interviewed him and played the interview over two programmes. But one question I asked him was, what message would he most like to leave behind him about learning English as an additional language as a result of his visit to Ireland to speak to teachers?
To pick up on a set of distinctions that a person called Richard Reese, an American scholar, made a number of years ago. He distinguished between language as a problem, or viewing language as a problem, viewing language as a right of children, and viewing language as a resource. The traditional way that we viewed linguistic diversity and children's knowledge of other languages has been as a problem. They have a problem because they don't know English. We need to teach them English. And so the first language has often been constructed as something problematic. In actual fact, when we look at what's happening in classrooms, or beginning to happen in classrooms around the world, when we look at children's languages and families' languages as a resource for learning, then all kinds of exciting things can happen in classrooms where the multiplicity of languages, the multiplicity of cultures is enriching for everybody. So creating a school climate that communicates this as soon as you walk in the door, and where children feel excited about being in a culturally diverse situation where they're learning from their peers and everybody has something to contribute, is a much more exciting place to teach in and a much more exciting place to learn in.
And that is Professor Jim Cummins from the University of Toronto. And although Jim is working in Canada now, he's originally from Dublin. In another programme, we covered the topic of home education. I spoke to two homeschooling parents, Dan Arnold and Gwen Peters, and to Gwen's son, Dannon. I asked Dannon Peters if he likes being homeschooled.
I think right now I'd prefer to be homeschooled for now, because I can spend time with my dad more. We're just a lot more flexible.
And is there a downside?
I think the only real downside about not going to a normal school is I don't really get to see tons of friends.
So how does Dannon get to meet friends his own age?
I like to play out on the green in front of our house every day after school. And you meet new friends, and it's not really so much during school, it's more or less after school is when we meet our friends, because we really only have like one family of homeschoolers that we that are really close to us, that we get together a lot with.
And what do Dannon's friends say about the fact that he is homeschooled?
Usually they say that we're lucky that we're homeschooled, and yeah, they wish they could be homeschooled.
It's difficult to say how many Irish boys and girls are homeschooled. 600 children are registered with the National Educational Welfare Board, but Dan Arnold reckons the number of children being educated at home is much higher than that.
It's something between 2,000 and 15,000. It's a big, nebulous kind of number, but it's growing at quite a fast pace.
And what would Gwen Peters say to other parents who are thinking about homeschooling?
Oh, I would say not to be afraid. It seems like a huge mountain, and you're thinking there's no way. And I have to be honest, I thought that, because I wasn't a very good student, and I thought, who am I to be doing this? But it's really a mountain that is actually a molehill. It's not anything that can't be done, because there's so much resources out there, and there is so much help available.
Dan Arnold agreed that plenty of help is available for parents interested in home education. He outlined steps parents can take if they want to find out more.
Make contact with a home educating family, which most listeners probably don't directly know. Secondly, look up HIN, H-E-N, or HIN Ireland on the website, and you'll get loads of information there. Thirdly, either from the website or wherever, get a phone number of a home educating family and go and talk to them, maybe go and visit them. Fourthly, ask yourself, if the thought has crossed at all, I'd love to home educate, or what's home educating about? Okay. Home educating is about you doing what you think is the best for your children within what you think you can do. If both parents are working away from home, in most cases it would be wrong to think that you can home educate if you're not at home.
And even if parents decide that home education is not for them, Dan believes that even considering the option is beneficial.
It's amazing how, when the question, when you pose it yourself, for a lot of parents opens up a whole avenue of, well, I'm a bit more interested now in how our children are learning in school. And a lot of teachers find that when the child goes to school who has previously been home educated, a lot of parents, a lot of teachers say that there's a good relationship with those parents because they have developed their own understanding of what education is, and they realise that when they hand their child over to the school system, to the principal, to the teacher, that's a skilled person.
And parents who choose to home educate need to register with the National Educational Welfare Board. In order to do this, they must undergo an assessment process. Emer Farrell describes how it works.
It's a two-part assessment process. There's a preliminary assessment. So once we receive an application, we contact the parents and then we go out to carry out our assessment. So the preliminary assessment is basically a discussion with the parent around the provision for the child. So, you know, we talk to them, and actually in our guidelines, there's actually a template of that assessment. So parents have a good idea beforehand, you know, what's involved. And that can remove some of the fear for them around, because, you know, obviously it can be daunting, the idea of somebody coming into your home and assessing, you know, what you're providing for your child. So the preliminary assessment is really a discussion with the parent around the provision, you know, what they intend to do, you know, different subject areas, how they maybe are going to provide for basic skills such as literacy and numeracy, if that's appropriate. I mean, obviously, it depends on the child. If you have a child who has special educational needs, well, you know, the provision for literacy and numeracy may not be the same as for other children. So it's very much dependent on the child's needs. So they discuss that, and, you know, they discuss other things then around, you know, how they plan to provide for the socialisation of the child, you know, those aspects that sometimes, I suppose, can be important in school, how they plan to do that at home. And very often people have, you know, fantastic ideas around those areas. They're in clubs and they're in, you know, home educating networks, and, you know, that's how they look after that. So after the preliminary assessment, if we're satisfied that the parent is providing legally what they call a certain minimum education, then the child is placed on the register. If we have any concerns around the provision, and that can be for, again, lots of different reasons. I mean, again, if the child has special educational needs or, you know, medical needs or some of those kind of things, we may need to go back to do a comprehensive assessment, because it may be very difficult to begin with to fully grasp what the child's needs are. So therefore, you know, to fully understand whether they're being met or not. So sometimes if we have a concern, we may need to go back and do a comprehensive assessment. And again, out of that, the child is either placed on the register, or we may decide that, you know, we're not happy that there is the provision being made for that particular child.
But Emer Farrell told me that it is rare for parents who apply to home educate their children to not be approved. In fact, the assessment experience is quite a positive one.
It can be a very good experience for the family as well. I mean, I've been out to numerous assessments where, you know, the children are dying to show you what they're doing and just talk about their experiences. So, you know, I think there is that element also, that people are now seeing it as, you know, a more positive experience.
And that was Emer Farrell from the National Education Welfare Board, closing the extract from the Home Education Programme, which is Programme 21 on our website. That's insideed.com. The final extract comes from last week's programme, where we had an interview with Brian Boyd, who is a professor of education in Scotland. Brian Boyd has done a lot of work in synthesising some of the best research that is available to us on learning. And one of the questions I asked Brian Boyd on the programme was, what children need to learn in school?
Well, I think that there's been a lot of concentration in the past on what you might call the basics. And the basics for most people would be reading and writing and arithmetic, and they remain absolutely fundamental. But they're not the only basics. And in a rapidly changing world, in a technological world, I think there are a set of new basics. And they're to do with thinking, critical thinking, creative thinking, problem solving, how to encounter and deal with failure, what kind of response you should make when things are not going well and when learning isn't happening in the way in which you want it to happen, how to work with people from different cultures, from different backgrounds, how to deal with circumstances which are not predictable. Whereas in most formal education systems, there's a heavy emphasis on the predictable, telling people about what will come up in exams, preparing them for them, coaching them towards it, hoping they can pass, and assuming that means the same as being an effective learner, and it doesn't. You need to give people the skills to be able to learn in circumstances which are new, unfamiliar and unpredictable.
If we take some of those one at a time, Brian, say if we take the creativity, how do children learn to be creative in school?
Well, children are naturally creative. To be human is to be creative. And if you look at, for example, a simple developmental process, which is the acquisition of language, Noam Chomsky, nearly 40 years ago now, indicated that that one aspect of creativity where children can take language, which they hear, but can use it in new patterns which they've not copied from anybody else. They can take words, form them together into sentences which they've never heard before. He would argue that means they're hardwired both to be language learners and to be creative. Now, I think this manifests itself in lots of different ways. Give a child a piece of paint, chalk, plasticine, whatever, and you begin to see them do things that they've never seen anybody else do. So it's about not so much forcing young people into situations to be creative, but nurturing their natural creativity. Now, there's a key issue here, I think, and it's to make sure that this isn't seen as a soft option. Because for me, the key element in terms of learning is that there should be challenge, and the challenge should be appropriate. In other words, if you want young people to be actively engaged, give them a challenge which they are up to, which they can actually engage with, which may be a bit difficult but not impossible. Make it something that with a bit of hard work, a bit of application, a bit of sharing with other learners, they can begin to make progress with. In Scotland at the moment, our new curriculum encapsulates the two concepts of challenge and enjoyment as being absolutely critically intertwined. It's not about making learning fun or making learning simple, it's about making it challenging, and in that way children are fulfilled when they come to learn.
And I interviewed Brian Boyd at the Edinburgh International Book Festival in August this year, and they were the sound effects of a summer afternoon in Edinburgh that you heard in the background. Brian Boyd was a guest on the programme last week, and we had a competition then to win a copy of Brian Boyd's book, The Learning Classroom. Thanks to everyone who entered that competition by text and by email. The first name out of the hat was Michael MacDonald from Terenure, who entered by text. The Learning Classroom will be on its way to you early this week, Michael. I hope you enjoy it. That's all we have time for on this week's programme. This is our last programme for 2009. I hope you enjoyed the sampler of our programmes this evening, and that you will tune into the programme every Sunday evening at 7:30 throughout 2010. I wish you all a very happy new year. I want to thank you for your support, encouragement and suggestions during 2009. Feel free to keep your comments coming in. You can get in touch with me by text at 086 8962 665. That is 086 8962 665. You can email the programme at insideeducation@dublincityfm.ie. That is insideeducation@dublincityfm.ie. Podcasts of previous programmes are available on the website, which is www.insideed.com. That is insideed, all one word, .com. Until then, this is Sean Delaney signing off. Thank you for listening.